day, and just put the soft racks on Hannah's car, so Holden Cruise. And the place he wanted to go, have you ever been to Boneyard?
No.
It's like,
it sounds like a nice spot.
Yeah, it's a good, I'm sure I would have died.
Really safe.
Yeah.
So it's like where you pull up at Marion Bay, you've got to go down behind the back of the dunes on this little sandy track.
Mm.
And it looked okay, but I'd also, not long before that, looked at my phone and had 3 missed calls from Hannah. Mm. Like 6:45. It's not, right. Not going to be good. And I had her car, and she needed my car to get to her boot camp. And she's, oh, Jordan, where are your keys? I was like, oh, have you checked my suit pants in the spare room? Yep, checked there. I was like, oh, they're in your car. Oh, fuck. And then proceeded to nearly get her car bogged down the back of the sandy track. I reckon if I'd gone 2 more metres, I would have been stuck, yeah. And it was not a good setup. It would have been walking 15 metres to get, minutes to get a farmer to tow us out. So
she would have been wrapped with that.
Did not get wet on the whole trip.
So. Didn't even get in?
No. Nah.
Did she make it to boot camp on time?
Yeah. She got picked up by participants. She was not impressed.
So did you drive all the way to Marion Bay, got bogged, and then just drove back?
Yeah, we went and checked out Clifton and Park Beach, but they weren't much chopped, so we just came home.
It's a nice drive.
Oh, it was Carson, who's a new bloke with footy club. He hasn't seen much of the state, so he loved it. He was up and about just from having been out and seen it.
So you're the tourist guide at the moment.
I was for that trip. I probably won't get a reprise, I would have thought. So. Welcome to episode 24 of Fair Dinkum Freaks. I'm Rev. I've got Tom on my right, Stu straight across from me.
We're back, full strength.
Back, yeah.
The well, based on what some of the comments I've just heard coming in, are we full strength? Don't know.
Sorry, listeners. Rev is a bit shattered at the moment.
I'm not shattered. I'm nervous.
That's up to you, Rev.
I feel like I'm someone's after me. So
no, you're rock solid position here, Rev. And what have you got for us this week? What have you drummed up?
We're just going to try and make you into a diamond here. No pressure on you.
Because you've started editing the social media posts without asking me. All the things I bring to this table. The only thing that I actually have at the moment is I know the password for all the accounts. Yeah. So I'm going to have to change it.
To stay.
You can't make the
indispensable
the social media write up for part two.
I must admit, I had to listen to the episode before doing this. I had to do it very quickly. You're right. Anyway, sorry.
You're just lucky I'm just running my checks and balances on the team.
It's very good. True. The listeners are probably happy that we're a well-oiled machine, very professional, and we put all this on the air for the start of the episode.
Everyone's a stakeholder in this, and I think it's important that we give everyone a chance to have input into the way we structure up whatever it is that we call this enterprise. So
transparent.
But we should actually give a quick thank you to the listeners, because we have really rallied of late. We'd be pushing 15,000 downloads. Oof, and
fantastic.
We thank you all very much for your support on social media, for just listening every week, and for everyone who's given a recommendation to one of their friends, that means a lot. So if you want to keep doing that, we'd be really happy with you.
We're exploding this second season.
We are.
Absolutely climbing. Have you seen the graphs, Stu?
I have. The one interesting point, we've got a new most downloaded episode.
Yeah, right.
Barley Part 1.
Barley 9 Part 1.
It just took over Harold Holt. Harold Holt was our episode 2, and that was extremely popular, I think, with the name, and very well researched and everything
well
else. But,
well backed up.
But yeah, Barley Part 1 is our new number one most downloaded and most streamed.
It's very well received by the listeners when we put it out.
Mm-hmm. Popular on social media too, so.
Absolutely.
Very good.
Credit to yourself, Red.
No. It's a team approach.
It's a new week.
So. Actually, I would like to note, after the scrutiny that's been put on my place, both those two top episodes were researched by myself. So just don't act too hastily, man.
We go week by week in here.
Low hanging fruit. He goes for the headlines every week.
Correct. But this one's a little bit more off the radar. So maybe we'll test that theory. So today I'm bringing you the story of the Whiskey A Go Go Massacre. Whiskey A Go Go was a nightclub in Brisbane's Fortitude Valley. Any other of you guys been to Fortitude Valley?
I've been there. To a very small heavy metal bar.
Yeah,
there.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the setup like?
So I went on the main strip, and there's just heaps of bars and restaurants.
Yeah.
And then you go further down to the bus mall. It's actually, some when I got off the train in Brisbane, Fortitude Valley is probably another 10, 15 minutes out of the main Brisbane CBD.
Mm.
And some people were a bit cautious of Fortitude Valley. Okay. That it's a bit of a rough area. Ooh. I didn't feel that there, but that's one of the train...
Like a King's Cross sort of setup, but not quite.
I haven't been to King's Cross, so I can't compare.
You would have just felt right at home, Stu. That's why you didn't pick up on.
Like-minded people, Tom. It felt very right. comfortable.
Just knocking around with the criminals of... Where are we? Brisbane?
Yeah. I'm not sure how you were going to answer any of these questions. I didn't even figure out which city it was. Yeah, I've been to a valley.
I haven't even started reading.
I love how you've absolutely come into the dark with this one, Tom.
Yeah, no. Yep. Don't know anything.
So the club was firebombed in the early hours of March the 8th, 1973. 15 people were killed and 40 were injured. So, and I think, Stu, you actually gave me a little bit of a snippet that it was one of the worst mass murders to that date in Australia.
At that time, it was, as you use the word massacre, and that's how the media considered it, that it was a massacre by the fire being lit with a purpose to cause destruction and kill people. Considered a massacre and one of the worst that Australia had seen.
Yeah, and certainly that purpose is something that there was severely malicious intent in this, and the way the fire was actually started in the building made it almost impossible for people to escape successfully. That combined with some poor safety standards and the fact it was 2 a.m. and I'm not sure about you fellas, but I wouldn't want a fire to start in any nightclub I'm at 2 a.m.
So. Absolutely not. Your decision making and critical thinking at that stage is normally pretty low.
You're not the best version of yourself.
No, not at all. So,
would this be considered a terrorist attack by today's standards?
Depends how you define terrorism, and that would be a whole other podcast. So I suppose you could say that. Domestic terrorism?
Yeah.
I guess so, but I guess we've got to get into the motives, Tom. What was the motives behind this? And perhaps they don't line in with terrorism, so to speak.
It's not in aid of an ideology, which...
Not looking to spread any malicious...
No.
And not looking to break Western cultures or Eastern cultures or any other cultures. There's other intent and motive, I think, Tom.
And we'll speculate as to that later on, because there's no real clear picture. And one thing about this is, very strange story, I must say. In researching it, I found quite a few twists, and hopefully I can convey those to the listener today. So I've taken most of my research from the book The Whiskey A Go-Go Massacre, which was released recently by Jeff Plunkett, which is an extremely comprehensive analysis and review of the case, really, that did actually break some new ground. So
when's this come out?
It was released in 2018, so
very recent.
Very recent one, and I recommend it. It's been a good read. To truly understand the Whiskey A Go-Go story, I think it's really important to understand one of the main protagonists, and he is involved in a way that may not seem obvious throughout, and his name is John Stewart. John was a real maniac. He'd definitely be on our top shelf so far, I reckon, in terms of wildly unpredictable characters. So he was born to David and Edna in 1940, and he was one of four children, Daniel, Jim, June, and John.
Jesus. Hard on the J's.
Yeah, they did. And then Daniel.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hard to see the thinking there. His father was a brutal man. He suffered tuberculosis and had back troubles that led him to be home on a disability pension, basically. Well, while John's mother worked, David would take Daniel and John to Surfers Paradise and basically send them out to steal from parked cars while they were aged about four or five. So
stable upbringing.
Oh, yeah.
At this stage.
What are you going to say? Take them surfing or something? Steal cars.
Yeah, Surfers Paradise should be renamed Theft.
Stealers
Paradise. Stealers Paradise, yeah. Klepto Paradise. So domestic violence was also a staple of the Stewart household. David beat Edna brutally and consistently throughout their 20-year marriage. And he also beat the children. I think there was one story in particular about David locking Daniel in a cupboard for a whole day once. And even though the neighbours could hear it, they were too scared of David to even bother broaching the topic.
Sounds like an intimidating man. And you can only see where John is going to pick up some of this. And it's the environment that he's been brought up in.
Yeah.
Uphill battle, I'd say, John was up against.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, he is completely cast in his dad's figure. And one of the interesting things about the Stuarts is that it's only speculated about John, but Daniel had an IQ of 139, was intelligent but a complete sociopath, just had no ability to feel emotions. And John's probably a bit the same, although from his writing and the way he communicates later on, I don't know that he's the sharpest tool in the shed, but he did had a lot of energy.
Okay.
A lot of capacity for doing things, just not necessarily constructive things. And they did actually look back and regret that they didn't focus on their schooling and took their lives down the paths they had to go down in the end.
So who's this, Daniel and John?
Daniel and John, yeah. Daniel wasn't a great person, but he wasn't quite as bad as John. We'll cover a bit of Daniel later on.
I was about to say, you're setting Daniel up just as much as John, which is quite intriguing.
No, what about the others?
They sort of float in and out of the story, but they're not huge figures. In fact, Jim, I don't think I covered anything about Jim at all. So
let's assume he just had it.
Jim
got himself was on the a right lawyer. Path and went on to great things.
Yeah. So with what would seem a perfect pedigree, John began his criminal career at 13 with a stealing charge. That was dropped, but by 15, he'd managed to accumulate another one and escalate towards building a reputation that would seem known as one of Australia's meanest criminals.
At 15?
15,
one of the meanest criminals, he'd just be a boy.
He was on the way.
On his way.
Oh, okay.
So key words there.
He stabbed a man, almost killing him after a minor altercation outside a taxi where he basically just picked a fight that only escalated because the guy was telling him he was no good, and he stabbed him and very, very nearly killed him.
Showed him, did he?
Yeah, he did. Fortunately for Stuart, the man survived, and somehow he avoided any prison time at all. So he basically got a suspended sentence with his mother going guarantor for his good behaviour up to the age of 18.
And was this with all these previous indications of him being an absolute pest?
Two stealing charges, and I would have thought taking one look at him based on how he's caricatured in terms of the way he looked would have been enough to suggest that bad bet by his mum.
Well, I think stabbing someone over a taxi is a good indication of it doesn't take much for him to snap.
Yeah, and it wasn't even that he wanted to get the taxi or anything. He just wanted to fight.
Go.
It was a weird sort of subculture that I don't know much about called bodgies. And it was basically, I suppose probably sounds a bit like punk, anarchist, bogan, somewhere in that vein.
Okay.
And he was a bodgie. So it was just a real pest to society,
yeah,
in a very violent way.
So what, anti-establishment?
I don't think really in a sophisticated way. Actually, one of the things that they're compared to a lot is, have you seen A Clockwork Orange?
That's what I'm thinking of, yeah, mods.
Yeah, 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 so like that, just like communicate in strange ways, dress in strange ways, behave in violent ways. Yeah.
Mm.
So what, no real purpose?
I think they're just like anarchists.
Yeah. So very much one of those. He operated under a few aliases. They weren't particularly
Stuart John.
What? So he's actually... And what is... I didn't realise how confusing that would sound out of context. So what, as in W-A-double-T. So his mother remarried a man with the surname Watts.
What happened when that one fell through? What did you go through then?
Water. Harry King. John Trouts, which... He actually spelled T-R-A-U-T-S because it's Stuart backwards.
Oh, right. I didn't. Yeah, yeah. Very good. You use that one, don't you, Stuart?
Then he did go by John Trouts, like the fish.
Oh, I was about to say, I'm reading the notes.
Yeah.
And that is not Stuart backwards.
No. Then that came in later. I didn't actually list that to begin with. Arthur Mason. He used Arthur Mason a lot.
Amazing.
Are you Stuart names? Arthur?
Yes.
You are. Oh. Oh dear.
Ooh.
You've been to Fortitude Valley before.
I have.
Some parallels. Interesting.
Oh, look.
You've played in heavy metal bands. You could be a bit of an anarchist.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
This is getting very, very close to home. Really? I'm feeling.
Yeah.
Is this a previous life that I've lived?
I experienced it with Seth Gonzalez. It can be a bit.
So I get the absolute maniac.
Yeah.
You'll have some interesting thoughts over the next week, Stu. Just stay strong.
Okay, thanks.
Unsurprisingly, he was unable to keep his nose clean and honour the guarantee that his mother had put up for him. And he was convicted of stealing a car 3 months later. So the story around this one's actually interesting, and it probably starts to paint a bit... Well, it's the start of a trend that John's never truly guilty of anything he does. His friend's wife went into labour. So John claims he stole the car, drove her to hospital, dropped her off and took the car back. But the police were waiting for him and they weren't too impressed with his story. So, despite his well-formed redemptive tale, he found his way to the Westbrook Farm Home for Boys until he turned 18. So there's a lot of stories about his crazy behaviour after his release. He terrorised police, terrorised basically any bar or nightclub in the area, just made a real menace of himself and had a really fearsome reputation.
Did he like having the stories... All these stories behind him of his crimes and things that he'd done, like beating up the person in the taxi rink and then stealing cars. Like, does he like that narrative behind him, do you think?
Yes, he does. More so than anyone we've ever covered. And I'll explain why in a moment.
Okay.
It's very pivotal to the overall storyline. Someone who very much enjoyed a narrative and liked to control shape and pump it up where he could. Mm-hmm. He was actually quite charismatic in his own way. Reading the book and reading some of the verbatim quotes, I don't actually really have any in here because there's nothing that relevant, but he has a very erratic, but I can imagine it would be an oddly fascinating way of talking because it's all very much just stream of consciousness, very fast and crazy and expressive.
Yeah.
So he had a bit of a following. There are a lot of sort of, I'd imagine, bodgies, younger criminals, younger disaffected youth who wanted to follow him, and he was sort of renowned as being the toughest guy around after his taxi stabbing incident. Yep. So
right.
So he moved to New South Wales when he was age 20, and he immediately hit a new peak in his criminal activity. Had a crazy incident where he twice escaped police custody by beating the police officers up, one inside the police station, and then ran away after they'd initially tried to arrest him on suspicion of beating his then partner Laurie. He was eventually taken into custody outside the hospital she was recovering in while he was trying to visit. Right. So, just
that's one incident where he escaped twice.
Yeah, so they tried to pick him up. They found him behaving oddly down a street. Then he got picked up, beat the cop, got away, got caught again, taken into the station, beat two cops, got out, and went back to the hospital.
And sorry, he went back to the hospital to his partner, Laurie, who he'd beaten up.
Yeah.
Well, what kind of relationship did he have with Laurie? Is that...
Oh, it's actually, there's a couple of letters in the book between them, and it's really pretty sad reading because you can just see that sort of stereotypical self-blaming forgiveness attitude of Laurie towards him, and him sort of explaining it, sorry, you know what I'm like, and she's just like, yeah, I know you didn't mean to do it. Sort of thing you hear of in abusive relationships. So she would have happily probably gone back to him, and I think they stayed in contact later in life, but not together.
Right.
Because he eventually went to jail for that. Believe it or not, you can't do that sort of thing. So during this period, we start to see a little bit more about, I suppose, the constitution of John. So he's struggling with his mental health. He starts to write in letters back and forth to Laurie that something's not quite right with him, that he's mentally not well.
And is this him reflecting in prison?
Yes, yep. Back and forth to her about how, he's struggling. He actually ended up spending time in a psychiatric hospital, and he was a drug addict at that point, or at least a pretty frequent user of methamphetamine. So I think a lot of the people in his crew of anarchists would have been pretty heavy drug users, feeding a bit of their behaviour. So, as I said, he ended up in a psychiatric hospital for part of it, but he did later claim that this was just something he did to try to make his time in incarceration a bit softer. I don't believe that. I think he was genuinely unwell.
Insane?
Yeah. I'll let you guys make up your own mind as we go.
What time frame are we talking about here?
So this would be, we'd be sitting at around, so he'd be about 22 at this point. So we were in about 1962. So we're still 11 years away from the fire. So upon his release, and as we discussed a moment ago, Stu, he did enjoy a bit of infamy, and he struck up a relationship that would fuel this and play a key role in everything that happens from here on in. Brian the Eagle Bolton was a reporter for a Murdoch publication, The Sunday Sun. He's described as a safari suit wearing, short, pudgy, heavy drinking reporter.
Yes, we like the sun on this podcast, don't we? Big fans of the sun.
All I can picture when I hear about him being a safari suit wearing, hopeless, fat bloke is Bob Fossil out of the Mighty Boosh. And I really hope he looked like him.
Yes.
So he found a niche as a crime reporter, and he had close ties to criminals. His nickname, the Eagle, came from a tattoo that he had. He was given that by one of John Stewart's close friends, Brian Phillips, after he supported the Phillips family in a difficult time after Brian's wife was injured by a parcel bomb that was delivered because of Brian's snitching, apparently.
Right. So, yeah. I was wondering how all this worked out. So he had close ties to criminals, and he's a reporter for a Murdoch publication in New South Wales.
Yeah. In Queensland,
sorry. In Queensland. Yeah. So, one of these things is going to give, and I guess the safari-wearing, pudgy, heavy drinker is probably the odd one out of this criminal organisation.
But it's interesting. This is a long-term relationship, and basically John likes to feed stories through to Bolton, the Eagle, and obviously he writes them up, puts them in the paper, and started to portray John as being Australia's hardest criminal.
Wouldn't John Stewart love that?
He did enjoy that. So, and it wasn't necessarily just stories about himself. He'd also feed stories through to intimidate, sort of try to make things happen, sort of, I suppose, turn his fiction into reality in a way, which we'll see as we go.
You mentioned it before, he likes to control the narrative, and he literally is helping write the narrative in the newspapers.
John basically figured out Facebook 50 years before it came out. They're just complete lies and portraying your life in a completely different way than it is. So well done, John. You're a trailblazer in social media.
So what articles is he writing? Specifically about John or just about the mad stuff that he's doing?
He was a crime reporter.
Yeah, so he was basically reporting on things that John had done, threats that he was giving. John had given him information about what was going on just in the criminal underworld. Yep. We'll see some specific examples as we go through.
Yeah, so Rev, would crimes happen and then would this reporter have a bit of a hunch on what type of people would have caused it? And is that what John Stewart was feeding him?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
So one example of a story he fed him was that he was planning to escape from prison, which is a strange thing to tip off a reporter with. And then also that they were planning on, that there were some people in the jail that were planning on blowing up part of it. So when he was in Boggo Road jail. And I think he did eventually set fire to a wing of it, but as always, claimed it wasn't actually him. So when he came out, he had a massive reputation. He was very feared. Continued to go around raising hell for a while. By 1965, he'd really become a really bad person. And he and a criminal buddy, Ducky O'Connor, were found guilty of the rape of a prostitute and sentenced to 12 months in jail. But concurrently, he was also convicted of the attempted murder of a prominent criminal figure named Jack Steele. Basically, what had happened was several people had jumped out of the car and shot at Jack Steele. One of them hit him in the shoulder. He actually got away and survived, obviously, hence attempted murder. But that was put on John Stewart. And this is one of the things that really drove the whole story. So John was adamant that it was not him. And he just vigorously defended and did crazy things in prison, protesting his innocence about that particular crime.
That one particularly? Because he seems to try and absolve himself of all his crimes, but is he focused on that one specifically?
For the next 8 years, very much so. And had crazy prison protests.
Is that because of the blowback of this prominent
criminal? Know why in particular. To be honest, there's not really a major crime he's convicted of that he doesn't argue. I think he took the rape of the prostitute without any real complaint. But yeah, this one, the stolen car earlier... There's always, he's always sort of protesting.
But I'm a bit confused because he wants to celebrate and create a bit of notoriety about him. Mm. But then he says he doesn't do any of it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I guess maybe to people that can put him away, he wants to be innocent.
Yeah.
But to everyone else, he wants to be the most feared bad guy on the block.
Very complicated character, quite often not coherent.
Maybe he didn't actually do this one.
There's actually a fair body of evidence that would suggest that he didn't. He was just a very easy target, which he had sort of brought on himself by making himself a very prominent figure.
Of course.
So he did his time in relatively tough fashion because of the way he carried on, and I think there are a lot of prisons who weren't particularly keen to have him at all because he was such a threat and their prison guards were so terrified that he'd kill them. But he eventually got towards his release date, and this is when he got back in touch with the Eagle.
Oh, what's he got here?
And he fed him a plot to bomb the Opera House. And then crash a plane into a crowded beach.
That's one plan, isn't it?
That was one plan. So he's going to load up a plane, which he hadn't learned to fly yet, with some explosives. He was going to drop them on the Opera House and crash the plane into a beach in a kamikaze fashion, unless his demands of a sit-down with the New South Wales Police Commissioner were met so that he could discuss his innocence as it related to the Steele case.
No better way to prove your innocence than... threatening like that.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. No, because that demonstrates sound character, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I just don't think that the point of getting rid of a conviction is met by replacing it with another one. I think you probably have some... Somehow he got let out of jail.
Yeah.
He's still, Jesus. They still let him go. I'm forever amazed by what the justice system was.
Did those threats make it back to the police commissioner?
This was in the paper.
I put it in the paper.
This was in the paper.
I need to try and find the article.
That's just crazy talk, though, isn't it? Like, no one reading that's taking that seriously.
And why wouldn't the Eagle filter that and go, is he really serious? Should I put this in the paper? I guess the headline might sell.
Like John Stewart, the Eagle was a man ahead of his time as well. Sensationalist media.
Absolutely.
We're seeing the bedrock of our society laid here.
Absolutely. Wow.
Good point, Rev.
Pioneers, these two.
So, as I say, his release date wasn't delayed by that behaviour. Although no discussion did occur, he didn't bomb the Opera House, as we know, because it's still there. So thanks, John.
Would have been a shame.
landmark gone. We'd be having a different podcast.
Yeah.
So in this period, he bounced around a lot of his relatives' houses, and he was especially paranoid. And his mental illness, which has since been understood as paranoid personality disorder, was causing him a lot of trouble. He had a huge amount of paranoia that someone was going to come and kill him, and that he'd upset the wrong people and those sort of things. So wasn't helping at all. And he soon, after that, formed another really key relationship that he would hold up until the end of his life with Inspector Basil Hicks, who was obviously a police officer in Brisbane at the time. And basically the point of reaching out was to establish whether he'd get a hard time from police in Brisbane at the time. And Basil Hicks was a really honest cop and renowned as one of the few who wasn't corrupt and had in fact convicted some of his colleagues for corruption, and so was pretty well trusted and well thought of. But his response to John was basically, if you don't play up, then you'll be fine. If you do, then can't guarantee anything.
What a wise man.
What did he do to show him the book of law?
Yeah, exactly right.
That was a real eye-opening moment for John.
Illuminating discussion. He really needed to reach out.
Yeah.
But poor old Basil didn't realise what he was getting into, because he must have spent a lot of time talking to John. There's a lot of conversations in the book between the two, and John is an erratic man by this point. It's like a text message group where you've got pages and pages and pages, and then a response is just like, yeah, no worries.
Yeah.
It's just the conversations between John and Basil. Basil really doesn't really take him that seriously and probably views him as a bit of a tragic, comical figure. And John's just constantly under Basil about this, that, or the other thing, so...
Yeah, yeah. He's just battening him off.
Yeah. So he maintained contact with Hicks, despite bouncing back and forwards between Sydney and Brisbane a bit, trying to figure out what he was going to do. But eventually they caught up in person and spent 3 hours together, in which Hicks noticed that Stuart was extremely paranoid, very cautious about where life was going, and just seemed to be constantly looking over his shoulder.
Where did they have this chat, Rev?
Under a tree. Under a tree and a busy shopping strip. It would have been quite a strange sight.
Under a tree.
Yeah, I don't know why I included that in the notes. 3 hours under a tree.
Important point, though.
Very important. In this chat, Stuart promised that he'd avoid his previous criminal connections in the Brisbane area. But this, unsurprisingly, was a lie. And he reconnected with childhood friend and probably another bodgie in Billy McCulkin, who notably had a mouse tattooed on his penis.
And did John know that?
Everyone knew that. It was a very important part of it. In fact, the book, being a very serious book, can't help but make a few tongue-in-cheek jokes about the mouse on the penis.
Oh, fantastic.
Is that his defining quality?
Yes. He's a piece of shit and he's got a mouse on his dick. That's Billy McCulkin.
Billy McCulkin, who had a mouse tattooed on his penis.
Mm.
How was it on there?
Well, actually,
come on, Stu.
The author, Jeff Plunkett, actually makes a comment that presumably when he got aroused, it became a rat.
That is good.
He's pretty good from Jeff Plunkett.
That is good.
He starts just referring to him as the mouse later in the book.
Just, that's what it becomes now. We've got the eagle, now we've got the mouse.
Yeah, exactly.
No, Tom, it wasn't. Yeah, I was wondering as well, but just your hand motions was. Where's he going with this?
Little hand.
Listeners couldn't see that.
But a little mouth.
Yeah, you were getting very descriptive with your hands.
So he did sort of make some efforts to live a constructive life, John. He did a bit of work for his brother Daniel on Stradbroke Island, but generally just continued talking with paranoia and hysteria about his bomb plot, and then he'd change that and do something else. But he always told Hicks that everything he did, he made sure he had an alibi. So whenever he was in public, he'd do something strange so people would remember him so that he could go back and go say, person saw me. So like he'd be in a cafe. One example given was he'd be in a cafe and he'd just empty a salt shaker in the sugar.
Yeah.
And just make a point of it so that if he ever had to go back and say, I was here, then that'd be someone who'd remember.
What, all the time?
Yeah, all the time. So everywhere he went, he did something strange so people would remember him. Because he literally just lives his whole life planning out alibis and trying to make sure that even if he is associated with something, he's away from it.
That's his mental illness.
Probably a bit of mental illness, but also just part of his enterprising criminal nature.
Just imagine how exhausting that would be, living your life that paranoid and you're always planning one step ahead just to not get caught or just to think of where you're at. Yeah, that's crazy to think of.
Yeah. This will all become very relevant in a moment. So
how'd they go? Did they stick to the straight and narrow track of how'd they find occupation?
No. So they decided that working for full time or generally wasn't actually for them. this is McCulkin and Stewart. So they decided to attempt a con job on the Royal Brisbane Hospital, where John was also doing a bit of work. And they claimed that John had sustained a chest injury, which was inflicted by McCulkin by just punching him in the chest really hard after work one day. And he went back and claimed that the cleaner left the broom out and hit him in the chest, that he picked up a worker's comp payment payout up until the whiskey fire. So,
what do you mean the broom hit him in the chest?
Yeah, the broom was left out and he walked around the corner and it hit him in the chest.
Like, we've got a combo.
Tread on a rake.
Yeah, like that. Yeah.
Cartoon.
He's a very comical figure in some regards, John.
Okay.
So that looked after the income for a little while. They also then tormented the owner, the manager of the whiskey go-go at the time, whose name was John Hannay.
This is our first mention of it.
This is our first mention of the whiskey. So this is where we're starting to, in amongst all of this, John is hanging around the whiskey go-go and the neighbouring bars and clubs, just being a pest, basically. And so they started to torment the manager over an alleged debt to one of their drinking partners and an entertainer from their dodgy pub, which was called the Lands Titles, or the Lands Office Hotel. It was just renowned. It was just known if you needed to find a criminal, you'd just go down to the Lands Office Hotel and they'd be there. So
strange name for a pub.
Isn't it?
Well, Whiskey A Go-Go, I thought, was a strange name as well.
Some rough names up there. Hmm. Yeah, but they're probably two of the worst. Lands Office Hotel. It's, I suppose the Mail Exchange, it must have some sort of historical tie. There's the Mail Exchange in Melbourne. I'd imagine it was just some sort of...
Sounds real boring.
Reference. Yeah, it doesn't. The Lands Office Hotel, so... He then made an odd trip to Darwin, during which his then partner Sue claimed that he lit several bushfires on the way. And she begged him to stop lighting bushfires. He was up to five. And he claimed that he'd fantasised about it in prison and that he planned to light 95 fires, which is an oddly specific amount.
When you first said he went to Darwin, it's a long way away from, you know, Brisbane or Sydney, wherever he is at this stage. Mm. Thought he would have flown. So we drove all the way to Darwin. And...
Well, it's hard to light bushfires from a plane, Stu.
Well, that's what I initially thought, and I thought, okay, no, he's driven.
Mm. He's got to scout the area and find the best fire.
Literally leave a path behind him where he's lighting fires.
95, how many did he get up to?
There's only an official record. Only an official record of five, so he fell a bit short of his end goal, but... I don't know, maybe
it was 35.
Bigger plans. He's going to do like 3 months backpacking around Australia and just keep torching it, I suppose.
Burn the whole continent.
Yeah.
Alibis all the way up.
Probably fair to ask why I'm telling you all this, because some of this is completely irrelevant, but I'm just trying to paint a picture of how erratic this guy was and how incoherent all his actions were.
Entertaining life this far, Rev.
Yeah, he is an interesting character. Not... particularly, we've looked at other characters like David Hicks springs to mind, where you could see something that you find redeeming. I don't really have that for John Stewart. He's just a dangerous cat. And so this is where we start to turn and head towards the path that we're ultimately on with this podcast, towards the Whiskey A Go-Go. So he goes down to Sydney now. He's all over the continent and he gets arrested for robbery. And so he gets locked up, but he's bailed out by an associate of a prominent criminal, Louis Miller. And on the way to the airport, heading back to Brisbane from Sydney, and Miller drives him and he asks Stewart about whether there's any money to be made in the nightclubs of Brisbane, and not in terms of working as a dancer or a bartender, by extorting them to basically
pay. Legitimate means.
No, not legitimate money. So are you familiar with what a protection racket is?
Standover men?
Yeah, basically. So you've got standover men and then someone comes in and seeks payment to protect from the standover men.
They provide you protection, but they are your biggest threat.
Yes. It's basically if you own the bar, I would come into you and be like, oh, bad neighbourhood around here.
Mm.
It'd be a
real shame if someone burned your club you've worked so hard for down. Yeah. Oh, you know, I could look after you for a fee.
Are they then the bouncers?
Effectively, but then sort of not as well. It's just literally a payment to not completely turn things on its head. So
yeah, I heard examples of when people refuse this service. Like, okay, then they walk out. A week goes by, something happens. They come back the next day and like, oh, what's happened here?
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe you do need our protection services.
Yeah.
Mm.
Conveniently was them that caused whatever, but that the issue.
Extremely relevant to where we're going here, Stu. So again... You seem to have an uncanny amount of knowledge about what's going on here.
I've done a little bit of research.
Do you think we need a standover man? Just to stand in here while we... do the episode.
The standover man is the person who threatens you. If you think it'd bring out a better performance from us, I suppose we could get an intimidating figure in if you like.
Just something to think about. Yeah. Stand the corner there. Just make sure we're okay.
Well, a waiter? Like,
rather that. I prefer a waiter than a standover man.
He's here for our safety.
I don't know if you've quite grasped it. If you were a nightclub owner in Fortitude Valley, you would have, yeah, bloody good idea.
Tom is very literal. Standover man. Yeah. That's all he's taken out of this.
Stand over the bagman. We'll get one each.
Oh, you would have been an easy target.
I thought your joke fell flat, but it came through in the end. Yeah, that was good.
We got there. And Stewart claims that Miller then suggested that John Stewart start hanging around the nightclubs of Fortitude Valley and basically to be look ominous and give them pause for thought about whether they were safe there. And then Miller would swoop in and offer protective services. Mm. So an interesting flag to plant there. I've got a little bit of a working theory about where this all ends up, but I think we're probably going to end up doing two parts on this, and we'll probably get to that in part two. Just a bookmark.
Nice tease.
Mm. This is where things start to really get interesting and, as I said, put us on our path. Getting back to Brisbane, John decides that it's time to sit back down with the Eagle.
Oh.
And they sit down sometime between New Year's and the 6th of January 1973, so we're a couple of months away from the Blaze.
Are they under a tree?
That was where he met police.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
He always met the Eagle in a bar because the Eagle was always pissed.
Fair enough.
So Stewart detailed an extortion racket that he'd been approached by that had told him to start putting pressure on clubs in Brisbane and the Gold Coast. And they actually planned to blow up an empty joint as a warning and then blow up a joint that's full. And they didn't care how many people they killed.
Ooh.
And he specifically stated that the Whiskey A Go-Go was a target. He told a similar but less detailed story to Basil Hicks. He didn't specifically mention the Whiskey A Go-Go to him, but he was trying to get his story out there. And when it was raised with other police by the Eagle, he didn't receive a lot of concern or credibility because most of the police thought that John Stewart was very erratic and that the Eagle was a hopeless pisshead. So those two combinations didn't alarm the authorities too much.
Yep.
But he continued banging on with his story, John Stewart, to anyone that would listen. And he was quite inconsistent at that time, probably, I would say, owing largely to his erratic nature. So he began harassing the owners of the Whiskey A Go-Go, the Little Brothers, so Brian and Ken.
The Little
Brothers. When put that way, it's terrible, isn't it? The Little Brothers.
The Little Brothers.
So they owned a couple of clubs in the area, Whiskey A Go-Go and Checkers. And he also started to harass another nightclub. But not in a sense that he was trying to threaten them, but just say that they were under threat. And he was really quite emphatic about it in a way that was very much, probably didn't appear to them as though he was actually trying to create a racket in the same sort of sense that we talked about earlier. He didn't really look like he was trying to install himself as a standover man because he was so hysterical about it. So
was he just trying to build fear in this community of bars and clubs? And is that what you think he was trying to do? Genuine fear, not trying to be the...
We'll have to come back to it because it's so important to where the story overall goes. So he continued to raise this with Basil Hicks in quite a hysterical way. And one of the things that he really, really communicated was a paranoia about the fact that he thought it would be pinned on him when it happened. Again, as we'll come to a working theory, it'd be interesting to hear what you guys think, but probably just trying to keep some doubt trying to distance himself from it, but also being right at the heart of it because he's feeding a newspaper, he's getting out there and telling people about it, but at the same time being very hysterical about it so that people don't really believe he's associated with it.
I can think of more effective ways of removing myself from a situation I don't want to be involved in.
So is this all hot air, Rev? Where are we going with this?
I don't know. We'll have to see. So on February 25th, the Torino nightclub, which was under construction in Fortitude Valley at the time, was set aflame. And 2 4-gallon drums of petrol had been rolled in and the entire premises destroyed. So
this is the empty one?
The empty one. Oh. And no one was hurt. The Eagle feared that this was Stewart's story coming to fruition.
Yep. I actually, I know the story of this one, the blokes that caught it on fire, one of them that served jail time for it, he had the barrels there. And because the fumes were in the building, it caught a light before they had everything planned.
Ah.
Yeah, and it yeah, I think, I don't know if he got burns from it, but yeah, it was just an interesting story that they weren't prepared for the fumes of the barrels to ignite the fire.
Yeah. Ooh. Everything's sort of going along with the story that John Stewart's peddling around. And even still, the Eagle again spoke to police and again he was rebuffed and basically became aware that they weren't circulating the story amongst themselves and that really no one seemed to care about it much. But he was pretty terrified of what was going to happen, and he still had a very paranoid John Stewart on the phone to him every couple of days reiterating the story. Basil Hicks is getting harassed and he's again just going down harassing the owners of clubs, trying to ring the little brothers, getting in everyone's face, trying to tell them this story. And he started particularly talking at this point about how the criminals that were in charge of it were young, inexperienced and ruthless, and that they didn't understand that you can't just do things like this.
Right.
He's got a lot of things. He's building a big lie here. It's not, he's not distancing himself from it at all. He's putting himself front and centre and really amongst it. Or maybe it's not a lie. Maybe he's giving a genuine warning. We'll have to see.
Probably something we can debate later.
Absolutely.
More details.
So police began to, obviously there had been an incident, so whilst they weren't taking Stewart's overall picture particularly seriously, they did need to investigate that. And they started to build a theory that John Stewart was somehow involved. Don't know how they were able to make that link. And that the fires were an insurance job with Stewart's presence as a front to basically eradicate the guilt of the parties involved.
Not a very reliable witness.
Yeah.
On John Stewart. Is that what they were thinking?
I think they probably... he was trying to get a step ahead and I don't think he had the ability to. It was probably what they were thinking.
Right.
I already told them I wasn't going to do it.
I was very proactive. Interestingly, one of his one of the key MOs they'd noticed of John was to make sure that he was locked up whenever something that he was involved in but not perpetrating was going on. And in one of the conversations with one of the police, they actually noted that he wasn't locked up at that time, which sort of shrouded some doubt on it because it was not his normal way.
But he actually
was locked up and they overlooked it and they didn't realise until after the fact that he had managed to get himself locked up for having a gun in his car after going to the police station and telling his story. So, again, just some interesting facts building in the overall picture. So, on the 27th of February, after spending the night in lockup after being arrested for possession of a firearm, which he had a trial date in April 4, which he was very paranoid about, he went to stay with his brother Daniel, who we discussed earlier. And he brought along a friend, Doug, who he'd just collected from the airport. Doug was British and he accompanied John over the next few days, aside from a visit to Basil Hicks, where John continued to push the same story despite Basil Hicks having still a fair bit of scepticism. So Doug was a really strange character. He was pretty unclean, came across as quite uneducated. And Daniel and his partner weren't really sure what was going on with Doug. But
was he here for business or pleasure?
No great explanation given. Okay. Well, we might see a bit later on. So
he comes back.
When they arrived at Daniel's house, he said, "This is Doug and you are only to call him Doug." Which is a strange thing to say, considering that is generally what you do with people who have a name. You don't have to basically
give him a name.
A fake name straight away. So, this is Doug. It's a real name. You want to call him Doug. It's not a fake name.
He does not have a last name. Just Doug.
Just Doug.
Like Bono or...
Brazilian soccer player, Doug. So amongst other odd behaviour, John visited the Whiskey on the 2nd of March after repeatedly trying to contact the Little Brothers by phone and spoke with John Bell, who was the head bouncer. And John had known John Bell for quite a long time. And he continued to repeat his version of the story. And he basically outlined that he felt he had three choices at the time. To flee the country, inform the police about the criminals, or to kill the criminals and flee the country. And he asked if, given that he'd be doing that on behalf of the Whiskey a Go Go, if they could finance his trip out of the country.
That's reasonable, is it?
I think not. And so did the people that ran the Whiskey a Go Go. And another important context is, and it was quite well known at the time, that none of the nightclubs had any money. They were all going broke. And the Little Brothers were in liquidation. So one thing that the police sort of kept coming back to was that they didn't feel that anyone who was really running a criminal enterprise would be doing it, because they would know, they'd do their research and find out there was no money to be had through a racket. So
the Little Brothers weren't driving around in BMWs, they weren't...
No, the business was going under.
So, yeah, it's an odd one.
And that's what they kept saying. They said, look, even if we... did think it was worth paying you, we wouldn't, because we don't have the money. So, all going in a lot of strange directions. He had another crazed conversation with Hicks after that and managed to get in touch with another more senior police officer, Inspector Becker. And then he implored the Eagle to join him as he went round some of the nightclubs with the reporter so that it would give him an added level of credibility while he told his story. And as he kept saying, tried to, I suppose, proactively clear his name before the crime was even committed. And so everyone was trying to understand, what is this guy doing? Why is he doing this? And so he planned the visits with the Eagle for the night of the 7th of March, so rolling into the 8th, which of course is when the firebombing occurred. So he asked the Eagle to meet him at 9 o'clock at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Presumably the Eagle had his back.
You presume wrong. The Eagle had been on the piss all day and got home and fell asleep after telling his son or wife, I can't remember which, that he needed to be awake at 9 because he has a very important appointment to keep with a very important person. And they had a saying in the Bolton house was that sleeping Brian was better than a drinking Brian. So he let him sleep. And he woke up later that night and realised he'd missed the appointment, but he didn't panic too much because John's whole story was that the fires weren't going to occur for at least another week or so. So he went back to supposedly a nice alcoholic slumber.
Ah, yes. Deep slumber, I'd imagine.
Yes.
All day on the piss, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. Just all every day on the piss, though, the Eagle. He was just that type of operator.
Drink hard, sleep hard.
John wasn't too put out. He continued going around nightclubs and basically continuing to push his story and making sure he was seen and just being a prominent pest and basically being turned away from entry to most places. Before quickly swinging back to Daniel's house and picking up Doug around 12 a.m, so we're on to the 8th now, the day of the event.
12 a.m.
And making his way to Flamingo with no sign of Doug. Don't know what happened to Doug in the meantime.
He went to go pick up Doug.
Picked Doug up from Daniel's house.
But he wasn't at
By Flamingo's. The time he got to Flamingo, Doug was not there.
Okay. But
at 2:08 a.m, a drum of petrol and a drum of floor polish, although it may have been a floor polish drum full of petrol, were hurled alight through the front door of the Whiskey A Go-Go. The fire raged at over 600 degrees Celsius, and inspectors concluded that all those who perished were dead within 3 minutes. Some guests were able to escape out the back door. However, the smoke blocked all visibility within 60 seconds, and with a poorly executed fire plan, including a very complicated lock on the side door and the locked side gate, the venue was a real death trap. As we said at the start, off the top, 15 people died and another 40 were injured.
Pretty horrific circumstances.
Yes, and to consider the layout, so it was an upper floor venue. So the opening basically went into, you know, those nightclubs where you go into bigger cities and you sort of go straight up the stairs, or like the Pooh Bar in Hobart.
Yep, iconic venue.
Iconic venue. Straight up the stairs and then had like a big dance floor with a stage at the end, but it was tables and chairs. It was not like people our age might conceive a nightclub.
A different time, Rev.
Yeah, exactly right. And then there was a side door probably three quarters of the way towards the back of the room on the right, and that was the way to go, but it was a bit of a mazy sort of exit. And unless you knew the venue well and probably weren't very pissed, it would have been very hard to locate in complete blackout smoke.
Steel chairs and tables everywhere, yeah, you'd be tripping over.
Exactly.
And the smoke filled up the place.
Mm. That'd be very disorientating, I'd imagine.
Mm, absolutely. And there was a big flash. It was a pretty big explosion, actually, because of all the flammable materials in the building and all the other flammable liquids around, so
the piss.
Yeah, all the piss would have gone up. So that would have gone up. Yeah, exactly. The bar would have been a nightmare.
Huge impact, though, Rev. The way they've gone about it, it's devastating. You know, the positioning of the barrels, people upstairs. It's really frightening.
Yeah, and we said off the top they had malicious intent, and John's also said through presenting his theory that these people don't care if they kill many people. So that's all come to fruition. Very sad scenes, and the book does go through a very detailed rundown of who was able to get away, some heroic tales. We might cover a couple of those in episode 2, because we will get there. We've been going for nearly an hour here.
There was a band playing at the time. There was a band playing. The Deltones, and members of that band perished as well, sadly.
Yep. Mm. So, tragic scenes. But to get back to our protagonist, John Stewart was sitting in Flamingo at the time, so established himself an ironclad alibi, which had been his main priority all along, having a drink with the bouncer Alf Quick. Very good name.
That's a bouncer I want to meet.
Yeah, Alf Quick.
Alf Quick.
and he was there drinking until approximately 2:15 p.m. before asking Alf to dial a phone number to check the time, which must have been a thing you used to be able to do. You call a number and it would tell you what the phone
what time is.
Yeah. I wonder if it's still connected.
That was Siri before it happened. We're talking about trailblazers.
Postmaster, yeah, exactly right. Siri, what's the time? Just dial a number and it'll tell you.
Very strange.
And he actually really insisted the phone itself had to be basically put back together by Alf Quick to make that call.
What do you mean by that?
The phone, Alf Quick didn't want to make the call for him. The phone was in pieces, but John was quite insistent. So Alf put the phone back together and rang the number for him so that he could hear it say 2:15 a.m.
Okay.
And then he left the club.
The phone was broken.
Hmm.
What kind of phone? Presumably one with
call. Nokia 3210.
Oh, yeah.
I reckon it would have been a dial, ring dial thing, yeah. So then he left. Doug.
The things we get hooked up on.
Yeah, we do. We focus on the wrong shit. Doug was nowhere to be seen, and John quickly went to his sister's house where he informed them that the whiskey had gone up.
How do you know that?
That's a question we'll have to pick back up when we get to part two.
Ooh.
The whiskey
again. He's leaving it there. I'm going to have a quick guess, though. Two barrels. There would have been a big explosion. He would have seen. Oh, was he pretty far away?
Oh, he wasn't miles away, but it was relatively contained. I think there would have been a bit of smoke billowing out, but no one. You wouldn't have specifically known what it was without going back there. Okay. So I think you're on a good thread there, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
John might know a little bit too much.
I also want to know what Doug's up to.
Mm.
This mysterious Doug character.
Yeah, you're only to call him Doug.
I know.
Why did Doug come all the way from England?
Mm.
Makes me wonder.
Yes. I'm pleased I've kept a little bit of suspense in this because it's not quite... Well, you're getting down a good path, but it's a bit more complicated than all of that. So
that's pretty shocking stuff though, Reverend.
It is. What? It is.
Horrific scenes.
Mm. Very sad for that loss of life and innocent life.
Presumably this was a pretty big story.
Yeah, so it would have been a huge news story. It was the largest massacre in modern times, post sort of European settlement, so
sure.
Front page news everywhere, one would assume.
The Sun just lighting that one up,
I would have imagined. Well, there's a
bread and butter for the Sun.
John, the Eagle. John is not the Eagle Bolton. The Eagle Bolton was pulled straight out of his pissed slumber.
Yeah.
And told to get in there. The whiskey's gone up, and he felt awful because he felt personally and partially responsible for not accompanying John Stewart on his walk around the clubs.
They woke the sleeping eagle.
The sleeping eagle.
He seeks a bit of redemption next ep, the eagle.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. Just continues doing his same dumb shit. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well.
So, we'll leave you there.
Very good, Reverend.
And, yeah, great job, Rev.
We have some theories to get through next episode, and even better, this is going to give me another week to research them a bit better and flesh them out so I can give you some proper information. But,
no, I think you've painted John Stewart. I can see him, I can understand what sort of guy he is, and quite a unique fella that I wouldn't like to meet.
Mm, quite a confusing guy. I don't know if I've completely worked him out yet, Stu, but I want to see where it goes.
Yeah, interesting. I don't think anyone really has, but there's some good theories we can throw out next week.
Yeah.
Good work, Reverend.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me back into the fold. I hope I've done enough to retain my spot in the three.
Yeah, absolutely, rock solid.
Yeah, bung you back out, sorry. We won't need you again.
Now, where can people find us? I know you love this one, Tom.
So, get in touch with us. We're always eager to have a bit of fan interaction.
Absolutely.
Facebook, Fair Dinkum Freaks. Instagram, Fair Dinkum Freaks.
What's the Twitter handle?
Send us an email, fairdinkumfreaks@gmail.com. And just the last one there, Twitter, just Fair Dinkum Freak, no S. No
and
S
apologies to whoever out there has fairdinkumfreaks@hotmail.com because you might have got a couple of errant words.
Yeah, just later. Go redirect those ones to our Gmail account.
Mm. As we said off the top, though, thanks very much for listening. And look, if you can, get us a review on iTunes. They're always very valuable to us. And if you know someone that you think would enjoy our podcast, make sure you give them a recommendation.
Yes.
Always looking to grow the listenership and keen to hear your feedback. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you in part two.